I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Chris Rinn. He's a forensic craniofacial anthropologist, which is essentially an expert in the anatomy of skulls and faces and the interrelationships between the two, who assists international police in human identification from skeletal remains and helps museums to bring characters from the ancient past to life, in quotes, by digitally sculpting faces on skulls. So I just think this is incredibly fascinating, and thank you for your work, and thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm a long-time fan. Been a fan for years.
Well, I have to tell you that, thank you for that. And I have to tell you that as I've been telling my friends I'm going to interview you and telling them about some of your cases, they have universally said, I know that case. He does such
really?
Amazing work. Yes. So they haven't known your name, but it's like, and I may be jumping ahead here, but like I mentioned something about the identifying people by their veins. And it's like, and that was a strong feminist who's like, that was, so we weren't going to talk about this, but can you give like a 30-second version of that and then jump into the other work?
The child abuse stuff.
That
was between about 2007 and 2017, so about a decade. I did all the image enhancement work on about 100 child abuse cases. And these were all cases where someone had been caught with indecent images of children on the computer. So they were already done for that. And some of the images or videos had an adult hand appear in them. So the question was, were they just downloading this stuff or did they create it, which is a totally different crime. So we were trying to assess if their hand was the hand of the person who owned the computer. So I used Photoshop and we did sort of vein pattern analysis, knuckle crease patterns, everything, hand geometry, any scars, you know, anomalies in the fingernail bed, things like that. And we had kind of it was almost 100% rate. I think about 80% of them changed their plea from not guilty to guilty after seeing the imagery. And the other 20% didn't change their plea, but they were found guilty by jury.
So
the sentences ranged from a couple of years to a couple of life sentences.
So let's back up now that we have that sort of dramatic entrance. And what do you do?
With skulls?
With any of this? Images? What is this? No. With your larger larger work, like what does forensic craniofacial anthropologist, what does that actually mean?
Well, it's forensic just means forum, really, and it means anything linked to the courts or the legal process. So a craniofacial anthropologist just means you study humans and the differences between them. And craniofacial means I've forgotten everything from the neck down and I just focused on skulls and faces.
And so give us some examples of the sort of work that you've done that people may or may not have heard of. And just walk
some
us through.
Of the the most recent one is this Interpol thing that was out last week, where they're trying to identify 22 women that have been missing, the unidentified dead bodies over the last 20 odd years from a few different European countries, and there's a kind of a big initiative to get them identified. But in terms of non-forensic cases, there was a woman called Lilias Aidy, who was a Scottish woman from Fife 350 years ago. Who was convicted of witchcraft and died the night before she was supposed to be burned at the stake. So extreme heat makes the air in the sinuses in the face expand really fast and kind of destroys the skull. So it was the only witch's skull in existence in Scotland. So I did sculpted the portrait of Lilias Aidy. That was back in 2017, but she keeps coming back. She's one of the ones that keeps coming back, which is ironic because the people that murdered her, tortured her, were scared that she was going to come back as a revenant. So they buried her between high and low tide under this big rock. And she wasn't uncovered for decades. But yeah, she does keep coming back. She's originally that was a BBC job that they wanted to do for Halloween, and it was a witch. So I assume they wanted something a bit more. I'm not sure, but I assume they wanted something a bit less like a nice portrait of an old lady that was lied about and tortured, because, you know, that's the truth. But it was Halloween. So, yeah, that was an interesting case, because I didn't know much about witchcraft and the witch trials and stuff like that before that. And it was the same with... I once did a Neanderthal skull for Andy Serkis to animate, and I didn't know that much about Neanderthals before that case. So it's a great great way of learning more about different types of subjects like that, because I get a skull from a museum and they want a portrait doing that's as accurate as possible. So lost track now. The Neanderthal was from the Middle East, around Iraq, and that was called Shanidar 1. And that was a great case to work on as well, because I'm not sure they were expecting a forensic reconstruction of it, because they didn't know that the individual, Shanidar 1, had suffered a lot of injuries earlier in life and healed. So he had head injuries. He was probably blind in his left eye, deaf in his left ear, semi-paralyzed down the right side of his body, and had a missing right hand. And it had been like that from teenage years, and yet had lived to the age of his mid-40s, this Neanderthal. So Margaret Mead was asked, what's the thing you'd look for the marker of the first sign of civilization? And she said a healed femur, because it showed that that was when people started taking care of one another, you know, an injury that someone couldn't have survived with on their own. And that's what we've got in Shanidar 1. It's just a lot earlier than we thought. And it's in Neanderthals. It's not in Homo sapiens.
How do you tell, for example, that the person was deaf in the left ear?
Well, it was all done from a digital scan of the reassembled skull. But the anthropologists who saw the original bones did a full report on it, and the Smithsonian had that. So you can tell from the skeleton whether there's healing, whether that bone's been broken peri-mortem around the time of death, or whether it was an anti-mortem injury that they'd had for months or years and there's evidence of healing. So they could see this big head injury on the left-hand side of the skull that had healed, and there was so much damage to the orbit, the eye area, and the ear canal. They were like, he must have been blind and deaf. And there was brain damage on the left side, and the whole rest of his skeleton on the right, the bones of the right leg were withered compared to the left leg. So he must have walked with a limp. Neanderthals had two-handed spears, so there's no way he could have hunted, fed himself, you know. And he was buried with a kind of family group. So they were probably the people who were looking after him. You know, there was a little group of them all in the same cave in Iraq. So this is the first. I mean, Neanderthals didn't leave any big structures, you know, architectural structures, but the human remains that they left tell us a story about how civilized they were, I think.
So let's say you're presented with a new case, with a new skull, and you are supposed to, what are you supposed to do? Are you usually supposed to build up a story around it?
No, the opposite.
So somebody hands you a skull. What do they say to you, and what do you do?
They normally start trying to tell you the circumstances, you know, because if it's a forensic skull, it will have been found at a scene, normally by a dog walker or, you know, and then reported to the police. And it's like they don't know whether it's a murder scene or whether it's, but it's unidentified human remains. There might be clothes, there might be hair, there might be evidence of what happened to them, you know, weapon, whatever. I don't want to know any of that when I start. I just want the skull and the skull shape. And all of that stuff at the scene comes in right at the end when you're trying to make the image photorealistic and put clothes and hair and everything on them. So you want to go in blind to avoid any kind of bias. So you need to look at the skull shape alone and sort of assess that for the biological profile, you know, the sex. Biological profile's four elements, sex, age, ancestry, and stature or height. And you can see three of those in the skull.
Wait.
To some extent.
Sex, age, ancestry, and height.
Yeah.
And first off, which of the ones can you not tell? And second, very briefly, how do you tell the others?
The only one you can't tell from the skull is height, because short people sometimes have big heads.
Okay.
You need a long bone to tell the height. Like the best one is the femur in the thigh. The more a bone contributes to the height of the body, the closer, the more accurate an estimate you can get from it.
Okay.
Whereas the others, so the best way to tell the age is by the dental eruption. Teeth erupt in the same order in everybody around the same time. So you can age a skull very accurately by the teeth up until the age of about 22 when the wisdom teeth come through. And then from then on, it's kind of deterioration. And so some things only kick in the 40s, like some of the sutures on top of the head start fusing together and obliterating in the 40s. So you can sort of say young adult, middle-aged adult, or elderly adult from the skull shape. But then you've got sex and ancestry as well. So there's kind of a interplay between them in that some of the things that you're looking to assess sex vary between different ancestry groups. Brow ridges, for example. So in like a European skull, you'd expect brow ridges to be in the male skulls, but not in the female skulls. Whereas in a Chinese skull, you wouldn't expect brow ridges at all, hardly at all in males. And in an Australian Aboriginal skull, you'd expect them everywhere. Everyone's got brow ridges. So it varies depending on some of the sex-based characteristics vary depending on ancestry group. So you kind of have to assess it together. And there's lots of lists of categories. But what ends up happening is, see, there's part of the brain called the fusiform gyrus that people used to think was a facial recognition center. But then they found out bird watchers use that bit of the brain to recognize bird silhouettes. And car experts use it to recognize car makes and models. So it's more of a specialist shape recognition center. And if you spend like a decade looking at hundreds of different CT scans of skulls and faces from different angles, all that pattern recognition goes in there. So now when I see a skull, I jump to a conclusion about the sex and the ancestry. And then I have to sort of work backwards and go, why did I think that? It's the same as if someone walks past me in the street and I go, that's a African man or a Chinese woman. It's a similar process. It's the similar shapes that you're looking at because the skull and the face are so closely linked.
That's all just incredibly fascinating. Okay, so they hand you the skull and you've determined those. And what do you do next?
I wouldn't say determine. It's not accurate enough for that. So you kind of, it's as accurate as if someone walks past you in the street. If it's ambiguous, the skulls, if a person's ambiguous in sort of a mixed race way and you can't tell where they're from, then the skull's going to be the same, similarly ambiguous, you know. And the same with sex to an extent, but sort of less so. Sex is easier to assess from the pelvis than the skull because it's more of a functional thing. So like every structure in anatomy and in nature comes from function. And basically the pelvic differences are to fit a baby's head through. It's all functional. But when it comes to the skull, it's less about that. It's more about the what the muscles do to the bone. See, everyone thinks bone's kind of solid, like a scaffolding, but it's plastic during life. It's alive like everything else. It's only stationary after death. It's just because it's the last thing to decompose that people think it's so solid, you know?
So what do you mean by that? That's interesting. I don't understand it.
If you're a bodybuilder, your big muscles are going to leave stronger attachments on the bone. Everywhere there's a muscle attached to the bone, you can see a little bumpy attachment surface. So everything that you do in life leaves its mark on the skeleton. You know, from chewing on one side of your mouth habitually will make your face asymmetrical, and it'll show up in the bone. You know.
Okay, so they hand you a skull, and you make an educated guess at the things you can make educated guesses about, and then yep. What do you do?
And almost that doesn't matter, because I'm going to do the same thing to it regardless of its demographic. It's the same process regardless of what sex or ancestry group or age. You've got these pegs that go on. At all these different landmarks on the skull, and their average tissue depths. Now, they used to measure those with from a cadaver by holding a needle over a candle till it went black with soot, and then sticking it in the face and measuring the clean bit. But now they do it from sort of CT scans, MRI scans, and clinical imaging. So most of these methods come from clinical imaging in one way or another. It's kind of like reverse engineering a CT scan. So you've got those pegs are average tissue depth. And then you've got a different scientific method for each feature. The eyes, the nose, the mouth, the ears. When it comes to ears, you can basically tell whether they're big or small and whether they stick out or they're flat to the head. But you can't tell anything about the 3D shape of the ear, which is a shame because it's really, it's unique. It's identifiable like a fingerprint. But it doesn't show up on the skull. The eyeballs, you can tell the protrusion. You can sort of tell the shape of the eye. You can tell the eyebrow shape very accurately because it's right across the supraorbital border on the bone there. The nose was really difficult. The nose took me 3 years of a PhD to figure out. So essentially it was with the FBI. I got access to a lot of CT scans of living people, and they'd self-assessed as white American, African American, or Asian American, which meant sort of Southeast Asian. In the UK, Asian often means Indian or West Asian. So it's and they'd just tick the box and then been CT scanned. And I took about 200 measurements around the nose and the skull, and then put them all through a statistical engine to try and get some equations out so I could take a few measurements from the bone, put them through these regression equations, and get measurements of the nose out. And then you end up seeing a lot of shape patterns as well, you know, so you can tell whether a nose is downturned or upturned, and whether the nostrils flare or not, or by the sort of the bone around it. And then the lips are all about the teeth. I mean, dentists know all about this. I had to speak to a lot of dentists because there's overbites, there's normal occlusion, there's, you know, an underbite, and they all have distinctive lip shapes that go with them. Mouth width is just canine width. I think that's a functional thing. I think that might be a cross-species thing as well. At rest, the mouth tends to sit, so the corners sit just outside of the canines.
I think this is all incredibly fascinating. Do you? I want to back up. Two things. One is, at some point, I would like to talk about some more of specific cases. But before then, this is really intensive knowledge. Do you? And a lot of detail work and. I know for myself that I don't really like detail work on some things, but when it comes to writing, you know, I will agonize over a specific word choice literally for days, or whether a comma should be here or not. And yeah. In other areas of my life, I find that sort of attention to detail almost unthinkable.
Yeah.
So tell me about yourself in terms of, I mean, that is an intense attention to detail. Is that just you, or do you like faces, or what's, do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, well, I come from a family of kind of petrol heads. Like, my dad and my two brothers were into engines, and I was the youngest by a 10-year gap, you know. So I was standing there holding the flashlight, looking at the trees, listening to the birds, and I was always obsessed with nature and biology and stuff when I was a kid, and my dad and brothers didn't get why. So that didn't fit. And then I was into sort of art and painting and lighting, and my family all thought I was gay. And then I told a careers advisor I wanted to do something that combined biology and art, and they said there's no such job. So I went to do anatomy because I was interested in sort of how the body worked. And there was an artist with a studio behind the dissecting room called Richard Neave. And he's in his 80s now. We're still in touch. And he came to show us how to cast body parts that we were dissecting using silicon. And I said, how come there's an artist in the medical school? And he said, artists teach doctors anatomy. Who do you think illustrates all the textbooks? So that's what got me into it in the first place. And that was like 25 years ago. So I went, after my anatomy degree, I went back to art school to pick up and carry on learning how to sculpt. And I've never really done anything else since. I can't, it's more of a symptom of obsessive compulsive disorder, I think. It's not like a job. I can't stop. And I can't really do anything else. I can't imagine doing anything else, really.
So it reminds me of a sculptor I knew, and it reminds me of myself. The sculptor I knew called her sculpting her beloved obsession.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the same with me with writing. And again, I don't really get obsessive about, like, I don't know, cleaning the house or something, but I certainly get obsessive about the word choice.
I was going to say it was a PhD, because that kind of breaks you. You know, but I think I was a bit like that before. The thing about a PhD is you spend 3 years doing something, like studying something like anatomy, and you come up with an idea and go, I think I've seen this pattern, and I'm going to take a bunch of measurements, pay a lot of money, and devote 3 years of my life to proving that this pattern's real. And by the time you get to the end of it, you go, it wasn't real. It's a different pattern. I was wrong. And oh my God. I thought I knew something, and I don't know anything. So maybe no one knows anything, and oh God, we're all going to die. You know, so I think doing a PhD kind of makes you question everything, you know, and breaks you a little bit. But I think I was already a bit broken before I did it, or I wouldn't have started. See, I was obsessed with skulls when I was a kid, because we had this murderous house cat that would bring in rodents and birds, and you know, I ended up with a little collection of animal skulls, just still have. It's just a lot bigger now, with, like, you know, sheep and rabbits and all kinds of, just found, because people started going, well, that's the weird kid at school, give him the skull that you found because he likes stuff like that, you know. So I think I was always a bit like this.
So,
but my dad was stuck in this job that he didn't like, and he just said to me, you'll regret it if you just work for money. So find something that you love doing and just keep doing that, and then hopefully someone will pay you at some point.
And you don't have to answer this if you don't want, but how does pay work for this? Does the does does a museum come to you and say, we want to give you X amount of money for doing this particular job? Or does BBC come to you for a TV show? Or does do the police come to you?
Well, yeah. I mean, it used to be all done through the university. So, but now that I'm working from home on this, it's called a haptic sculpting armature. I think took to a computer. It was like 10 grand's worth of equipment. And the first case was someone sought me out because of an old face that I'd made, Rosemarkie Man, this ancient Pictish guy that they now think he might have been royalty, but was brutally murdered like 1700 years ago. And she'd seen that black and white still photograph of an image that I made in 2016. And she was in charge of the Whithorn Priory project. So they had a bunch of medieval bishops and it was all run by the Whithorn Trust. And she was like, can I commission you to sculpt three bishops and a young woman? And I said, well, yeah, but I don't have a computer to do it on at the moment because, you know, COVID changed a lot of things. And yeah, I'd love to, but I don't have a computer. And she said, how much did the computer cost? And that's how much she paid me to do the first four faces, which was very good timing because I honestly didn't know what else I was going to do at the time. And then after that, because they went a bit viral and popped up in sort of Smithsonian magazine in the States and stuff. Yeah, I started one of them as well. The forensic work started coming in because an old forensic case that I'd worked on a few years ago was recognized by some witnesses and a retired cop was following it up. And he said, will you, you know, do some superimpositions? So, yeah, there's three different things you can do when it comes to forensic skulls and faces. If the body's pretty fresh and there's not much decomposition, you can Photoshop the mortuary photos, and that's called post-mortem depiction, to make them look alive for public release. Then if they decompose past a certain point and it's just the skull, you have to do facial reconstruction based on the skull. But then if there's missing persons photos and you've got a 3D skull, you can align it to them. This is called a craniofacial superimposition. And if there's a bunch of photos of someone from different angles, especially if you've got short hair, it's much more accurate, obviously, then you can align the 3D skull with all the different missing person photos and say it's definitely not them, or there's quite a high chance that this is them. You can't say it's definitely them. They have to go and check DNA match and stuff for that. But you can rule. It's a more of an exclusionary forensic process, you know. But yeah, when an old case gets recognized, even if it's something that I sculpted 10 years ago, if it gets recognized, I'll do some craniofacial superimpositions and say that could well be them. And then they end up following up on that. So the interesting thing about this as a forensic process is it's last resort when nothing else has worked. You know, DNA's not worked, dental records haven't worked, fingerprints, the four primary identifiers, x-rays, none of that's worked. There's no other investigative leads, so we need to generate some investigative leads. So maybe putting out an accurate enough portrait of them might get a recognition reaction from a friend or a family member. And if it does, they might have a toothbrush with some DNA on it that they can compare to the body. And that's how you get the match. So if it doesn't work, it's at the end of the investigation. But if it works, then the investigation carries on and you end up somewhere in the middle of it. So it's a bit peculiar. I've never had to stand up in court and defend the accuracy of it, because if it works, then you can see. You know what I mean?
So does this, maybe this is a silly question, because I guess you would, but does it bring you some amount of some emotion to be able to, for example, you know, let let a parent know that, I mean, obviously it's sad, but let a parent know that, yes, this is their kid, or to or to help bring a pedophile to trial. I mean, is there a certain amount of satisfaction in all of that?
Yeah, I mean, it used to be a lot more abstract for me because of the I hadn't suffered much of anything, you know, to identify with that kind of trauma of having a loved one missing and not knowing what happened to them, that not getting that closure of knowing. And I had no way of knowing what that felt like until I lost my mum to COVID in the first wave. The whole care home went down. I've seen a lot of dead bodies in my life, and they wouldn't let me see my mum. I wasn't allowed to bury her. So I wasn't allowed to speak to her on the phone for the last 4 days of her life. So it doesn't feel real. And 3 years later, it still doesn't. So you need that closure. I was begging them to just take a photo of the body and send it to me, then I can see it. But no, not allowed. And it messes you up. So, yeah, now I'm thinking all the ones that got identified, that must have had such an impact on people's lives, you know. There was one of them. This was a case in Thames Valley in about 2016 or 2017. And it was a skeleton found in, it must have been there a while because there was no soft tissue, complete skeleton, dry bone. And the only thing that was left of the clothing was the little tag at the back of the neck, because it was polyester. And that said Lithuania on it. So they sent the face that I made to the Lithuanian Missing Persons Bureau. And one of the staff there was looking through missing persons photos and went, oh, yeah, it's this guy. And it turned out that his mum, his only family was his mum in Lithuania. And she'd passed away a month before they found his skeleton.
Wow.
So she never found out. So he'd moved to London, spoke to her every day, like I used to speak to my mum every day, and then suddenly stopped talking to her. So she knew something was wrong and never found out. And see, now the body's identified. They've still not caught the murderer. They know it was a murder. They know it was in the gay community in London, and he was killed with blunt force trauma to the head, and they don't know who did it.
Tell us about sorry to be so sort of spectacular, but tell us about some of your more other most interesting cases. And they can be ancient. I mean, I think that's really fascinating that you're supposed to reconstruct, you know, long dead bishops, or or the one about the guy who was murdered, what, 1400 years ago? How many years ago did you say it was?
1700, I think.
Yeah, 1700 years ago. Or the woman who was tortured for being accused of being a witch. So give us some greatest hits.
What were some other ones? There was an ancient Egyptian princess, teenage princess, they said. It went out on Channel Art in French. I don't know if it's been aired in English. But that was an interest. Ancient Egyptians are always great to work on, but very risky because of the sort of politics around it and the appearance and the, you know. See, ancient Egypt had its own archaeologists, which blows my mind, you know. It was ancient even to them. So,
oh, I just read this thing the other day that Cleopatra was closer to the moon landing than she was to the building of the pyramids.
Yeah.
But anyway,
so it's kind of mind blowing. I mean, it's always a risk because you really don't want to misrepresent an ancient Egyptian in terms of ancestry more than anything else. Very sensitive area. As you can see by the new Netflix thing that's causing a bit of a stir, because it was all recorded and in artwork, and in history, you know, it's not prehistoric. It's all there. So yeah, I was working on this. It was a teenage, it was 16-year-old, and I said, "Princess," but the documentary was called.
Wait, a 16-year-old. Yeah. You know she's 16 because of teeth, right?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
15 to 17 was the assessment.
Yeah. Because of it was, teeth.
Yeah, anything over the age of 25, it gets a bit more. The ranges get bigger and bigger, you know. But when it's a teenager, you can tell by the dental eruption. So they said, you know, she's 15 to 17. Okay, so I thought, I can tell that she's got a very narrow nose because it's not a skull, it's a mummy. So a lot of the soft tissue was there, just mummified, shrunk, dried. So she's got a really small palate, dental palate, narrow nose, and I can see all this stuff about the eye shape, but I'll keep it black and white because I don't want to upset anybody, because you can't tell skin tone from the skull, just shape. So I did a black and white version, and they said, well, we need it in color because all the jewelry that we want you to put on her is colorful. So I'm like, well, okay, were there any paintings in the tomb of these girls? Who were these girls? Because there's like 50 young women all together in this one tomb. And the documentary's got the word harem in it. And, you know, was she a princess? Was she a daughter of Amenhotep III? Or was she a consort? What's the story? And they said, well, we don't know which. She was either part of his family or part of the harem. And there's no way of telling. Either way, she's got to be pretty and be careful. I'm like, oh, God. So, you know, I said, well, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. Face shape's linked to skull shape. This is the face shape. Were there any paintings? Because I don't know what color to make the skin, you know? And they said, well, yes, there's paintings all over the tomb. So they sent me all these photographs. And I said, well, what was the pigments that the artist used to paint the skin? And they said it was iron oxide, which is rust. So I drive around a 20-odd-year-old school bus. So I went outside, got underneath it and took some photos of rust, put that in Photoshop and just tinted my black and white photo rust color, which kind of looked like a skin tone. And that was fine. And I still got people saying, it was kind of a 50-50 split, people saying she was either too dark or too pale and complaining about this skin tone that wasn't even a skin tone. It was just rust color. So ancient Egypt's ancient Egyptian skulls are great to work on, but it's dangerous, you know, politically. It's you're always going to offend somebody.
Right. This is off the subject of that, but were they all killed when he died or something? How did 50 girls end up in?
I'm not sure. Really, you know, I wouldn't like to hypothesize on it because I don't know if it was. It didn't look like. See the scan that I was working on wasn't even a CT scan. It was an iPhone scan of a mummy. So I can't really speak to the sort of cause of death or anything like that unless I get CT scan. There was an X-ray from the front, which was really useful to see the teeth, because when you mummify around the mouth, it changes the whole shape and they kind of pin the mouth closed and hide all the teeth. And if you're trying to separate mummified tissue in a CT scan, it's almost the same density as bone. So it's difficult once it's dry, you know, to get a clean skull out of a CT scan. But yeah, we still don't know. The tomb's called KV40. They're still doing that kind of work on it.
So you mentioned early on the work you're doing with the bodies of the women, the 22, I believe it was.
That was just one case that I was sent one skull, you know. just a normal forensic case, but a cold case because it was 20 years ago. And I worked on that case and sent it. That was from the NFI, the Netherlands Forensic Institute. It's a bit like the, it's not like the Dutch FBI because it's, the I stands for institute. It's not like a, you know, bureaucratic kind of organization. It's, it, well, it is, but it's a kind of a Dutch federal police. But it's an Interpol case. So I didn't realize this. I just did that one case for the NFI and it was part of a much bigger kind of motion with all these other cases that come from outside of the Netherlands, like Germany and Belgium and all over Europe. They're just all the unidentified women over the last 20 years or more, and just making another push to get these people identified, because a lot of them are not that old either. It's you know, sometimes you can tell from the scene that this is kind of an older person who's, or it's a suicide, or it's an accident, or, you know, it's not like a brutal murder of a young woman. So I think that's why they've grouped all these 22 together and to do like a public outreach thing. And it's really been successful so far. They've had 200 calls in the last few days.
That's great.
200 from the public saying, I think I know, not all on my case, on the 22, it's averaging like, you know, 10 each. But yeah, that's a lot of calls for such old cases from years ago.
So what is another of the oldest ones you've ever done?
The oldest. It's always great. Living in Scotland and working on Pictish faces is always good, because everybody around here wants to know what ancient Picts look like, because the only thing we know about them is that they painted their faces and they had facial hair. Sometimes it's depicted as mustaches, but mostly depicted as full beards, and they're covered in blue paint, you know. And they don't know much else about them in terms of appearance. So it's, yeah, that always gets a good reaction. I'm working on one right now that's going to be out next year, and it's a ancient Egyptian priestess from Thebes, which is going to be interesting because it's ancient Egyptian again. But yeah, the other interesting thing about the Neanderthal was this, I was working on that around the same time as they found out that most people outside of Africa have Neanderthal markers on their DNA, like up to 2%. Which doesn't sound much, but if you think that each parent's 50%, each grandparent's 25, each great grandparent's 12.5, you get to 2% in a few generations. It's not the same thing, but you know, it's 2%'s a lot. And they can reconstruct about 80% of the Neanderthal genome by putting the bits together from all of us. Hmm. There's none on people from sub-Saharan Africa. Hmm. It's all outside of there. So that says two things. One, we bred with them, which means there is no them. We're the same species, produce viable offspring. And so, yeah, Neanderthals were basically out of Africa a long time before Homo sapiens. They were settled in Europe. They evolved through an ice age. They got red hair, pale skin, freckles, nicotine addictions, you know, a lot of the things that we still have here today. And yeah, and essentially modern Europeans are mixed race African Neanderthals. They were a race, not a species, unless we change the definition of species, which they've done. So we can still say that they were a different species. But the thing that really got me was I was expecting it to be a lot, I was expecting the Neanderthal skull to be a lot more different than it was. Because, you know, when you see the photographs and they hold up a Neanderthal skull against a modern human, that modern human is a young female.
Oh, so they're doing it to make it seem like it's bigger than it is.
Well, the Lithuanian forensic case that I worked on, the brow ridge on that skull was huge. It showed on his face, but it didn't. It wasn't. But there's a Russian boxer whose name I forget. He's a huge fella, bald, and he's got a big brow ridge, which is totally comparable to the Neanderthal brow. I'd love to get a CT scan of his skull and overlay it in 3D and see how different it was. Because, you know, if they took a big skull of a modern human who looked like a Neanderthal and held it next to Neanderthals were quite small as well. They were only about 5'5". And their skulls were bigger than ours. The brains were bigger than ours. So it's a bit like wolves versus domestic dogs. And they asked in the documentary that I ended up making with the Neanderthal case, they brought in Svante Paabo, who's won a Nobel Prize recently. And the Russian boxer's known as Beast from the East, Nikolai Valuev. I don't know how to pronounce that. They brought in Svante Paabo, who won a Nobel Prize last year, to ask him what's the difference between Neanderthals and modern humans, because he's the sort of global expert in Neanderthals. And he said, I think they weren't as crazy as us, because they had things like adhesives. They invented adhesives by making tar that took several people working in a team several days. So they invented mass production as well, if you think about it. But the one thing that they didn't do was sail out onto water when they couldn't see land on the other side. They were cautious. Whereas modern humans, he said, think how many humans died at sea before anyone ever hit Easter Island, right in the middle of the Pacific. We have this kind of reckless bent Homo sapiens that Neanderthals didn't have. That's why we've spread to cover the face of the earth. You know, because we keep thinking maybe over the next hill is something better. Maybe right. If I keep going in that direction, I'll be happy or something.
So this is really fascinating, but we're starting to run out of time. And two things. One of them is whenever I hear, whenever I read about like King Richard III being found in a parking lot, or whenever I hear about some person who's been long dead, it always gives me these weird existential thoughts of sort of, you know, what is the point of life? Not in the bad sense, but it's like, you know, I mean, you were a king and now you're underneath a parking lot and you got stabbed in the behind. And what, you know, like, so what does dealing with all this, with all these dead people, is it just, oh, this is a skull, or does this
turn me into a nihilist?
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is does it lead you to some sort of existential crisis or anything? It's okay if it doesn't.
No, I've always been a bit like that, though. I think I've always been a bit of a, I was raised Irish Catholic, you know, they're just obsessed with sex and death. That's it. It's one of those things that everybody talks about all the time, but nobody ever talks about. It's just, you know, it's the only thing we've all got in common, and nobody knows what happens. Nobody. And that's freaky to me. Like, I'm obsessed with death and terrified of it at the same time. I mean, it'd probably be worse if I had children, because then I'd be worried about what would happen to them after I died, or what would happen to me after they died, and all of that stuff, you know, that kind of thing. I've made my life very small now, so that I see more dead humans than living humans on a daily basis, and I see more wildlife and animals than I see people. So it's kind of, I guess it has made me a bit withdrawn and isolated, yeah. But I think that's more about the whole justice side of things as well. When you end up working with the police and the justice stuff, it's animals don't lie. Humans lie. And that bugs me. So I think I've ended up just gravitating more towards animals than people. because working with in forensic cases, just you have to sort of push through the story, you know, to the truth. And it's not that everybody has their own truth. There's just truth. It is an objective thing. Reality, it's an objective thing. It's not something that we completely understand, and it is something that's terrifying. But yeah, well, I think it's made me cynical.
Is there anything else you want to say before we go on this one? And I'd love to do another interview about more of the work having to do with justice.
Yeah. I don't know, really. It's I'm not sure what my father would have thought of all of this, to be honest, because the idea that I work mostly with police and things like organizations like Interpol and the FBI, and the only experience my dad ever had with police was the one that lived next door and argued with him all the time. I sometimes wonder what he would have thought of it, because he passed away just before I met the FBI agent that got me into it all in the first place.
So I think for, A, your dad would have been pleased because he told you to do what you love.
Yeah.
And B, I mean, how can anyone object to someone helping to find, to bring closure to a mother who has lost, who doesn't know what happened to her child?
I mean, my dad was always the kind of, he wanted to always ask. He had a lot of questions for priests, you know, about contradictions in scripture and stuff. And it was all about, you know, you need to reassure me that things are going to be okay after I die, because I've had a heart attack and I might die. So please tell me that it's going to be okay. You know, so he was really obsessed with death in that way, because he was ill for a long time. So I think that's probably where I got my obsession with death from. But I've always been more obsessed with it in a more mechanical, kind of anatomical way. And if you spend time on a daily basis working around, you find this little off switch where you just flip into professional mode. And when I'm around dead bodies, it's just normal.
You know, it's this, I've talked with surgeons. It's the same way. You know, you can't be thinking, oh my God, I'm stopping somebody's heart. You just have to be doing your job. And it's the same with me when I write about atrocities. There is stuff that I write about that would be much harder to write, to read, than it is to write. Because when I'm writing, it's like I'm trying to make the sentence make sense. I'm trying to figure out where to put a comma. I'm not actually dealing with the atrocity when I write the sentence.
Yeah, and it often kicks in. I mean, this is where the peace comes from in PTSD. It always happens post. It's after.
Yep.
When you're in it, you're just in it. And it's like, of course, this stuff's giving me nightmares. It's like if I watched horror movies all night, every night, that would give me nightmares. That's normal. It only becomes abnormal years later when you're going, why am I freaking out every time I hear kids play out in the street? You know, why am I flying into a rage for no apparent reason at random times of day for just because of an audio trigger, like a Vietnam veteran hearing a car backfire? It's crazy. You know, so it's I'm okay with dead bodies. It's the cases that involve living victims that really mess you up, I think.
Well, I would love to explore that more, but we are really out of time. So let's plan on making another conversation about your cases with living victims.
Cool. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for the work in the world, and thanks for the conversation. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Chris Rinn. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.